Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Liza Keller. In this episode, we discuss the current state of China's financial system. The Chinese Communist Party has overseen the most rapid economic growth in recorded history over the last 30-plus years. One product of China's unprecedented growth is the significant expansion of China's financial system, a system that up until now has managed to stay on the rails of growth through government policy intervention and confidence in the steady and consistent hand of party leadership on economic decision-making. Yet new analysis from CSIS and the Rhodium Group shows that the outlook for China's financial future faces deep-seated problems if reforms aren't implemented, and Beijing appears aware of the challenge. The problem is that ongoing deleveraging is exposing other flaws and risks in the system, and much-needed reforms may expose even more, further limiting credit growth, which could in turn trigger crises in China's financial markets and banking sector, thus leading to the very economic crisis and instability party leadership hopes to avoid. Joining us to discuss their fresh analysis of China's financial situation are Mr. Logan Wright, an adjunct fellow with the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS and Director of China Markets Research at Rhodium Group, and Mr. Daniel Rosen, a senior associate with the Freeman Chair in China Studies and founding partner of the Rhodium Group. Logan and Dan are co-authors of a new report that breaks down the pillars of China's financial system and utilizes intensive data collection to provide a more accurate picture of China's current credit situation. Logan and Dan discuss their methodology in preparing the report and key findings that stood out. They also touch on some of the challenges to Beijing in moving forward with financial reforms while attempting to maintain stability in China's credit system and explain what this potential area of weakness in China's economy means for U.S. policy. Logan and Dan sat down with my colleague Dr. Scott Kennedy, Deputy Director with the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS and Director of our Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy, to talk about their new report. I'll turn it over to Scott now.
This is Scott Kennedy with the Freeman Chair in China Studies, and I'm at CSIS with my good friends Logan Wright and Dan Rosen, and we're here to talk about their amazing report, Credit and Credibility, Risks to China's Economic Resilience.
Hi, Scott.
Thank you all for taking on this monumental task and putting together this crucial report, which I think is going to find a very wide audience in Washington and elsewhere. Maybe you could give us a little sense of how you got the idea for doing this in the first place and taking on this humongous task.
Yeah, it's. This essentially is a question that we've been debating and getting wrong and dealing with for decades now, right? How much longer can China's growth as we know it go on? And that's something which in day-to-day work, all of us grapple with all the time. Logan, who focuses a lot on financial markets in China, me focusing on the larger GDP outlook of the system as a whole, constantly wrestling with our framework, our understanding of how has China bucked the trend and been able to remain so resilient, reporting such high growth for such a long period of time, whereas there's basically no other examples of large economies being able to pull it off quite the same way for so long. So the question's really been begging to be asked, and it was our conjecture that there are new things happening, in fact, over the past half decade that, with a correct understanding of why China did well in the past, actually give us reason to be quite concerned about whether that can be sustained out into the future.
Yeah. And one of our key contentions in this book is that a lot of the more conventional arguments for China's economic resilience are starting to become strained under the pressure of a very different fundamental conditions in the financial system in the last 5 years, as well as a much faster growing and more complex financial system. So the purpose of this report in many ways was to sort of throw out the old conventional wisdom and try to reestablish it and to try to update what we really can say about the sources of stability within the Chinese financial system and how they might be changing.
I was curious because, you know, I try to follow Chinese industrial policy and the policymaking process. And for that, you know, basically I get on a plane, I go find people, I chat with them again and again and again to get stories. You can't follow China's financial system that way, right? You've got to have like mountains and mountains of data that you can crunch and collect. But China's not an easy place to get data. What is it like to try and collect financial data on China and get it to a level where you feel comfortable that you can do an analysis with it? Is it more similar to the type of stuff that I do on the ground than I realize?
Yeah, I would say it's more time-consuming, if you will, and requiring discipline rather than being fundamentally difficult. In reality, I think China's financial system data are some of the best produced within the Chinese system, in part because they are not calculated from local government individual reporting and projected out to the national economy. They're actually accumulated from the bottom up. And so what you'll see in this report is a combination of some of the approaches we take in our private sector work as well, where we're looking at top-down credit aggregates, we're looking at top-down banking system aggregates, but we're also looking at a lot of bottom-up data from individual financial institutions and non-bank financial institutions, and we're trying to combine all of those together to figure out in a follow-the-money type approach, what's really happening within the Chinese financial system and how we can add this up to make a coherent picture. In many ways, it's more about knowing what to look for and deductively framing what the real data that matter are rather than a difficulty in finding them per se.
Yeah, I mean, I would have, for the most part, the data are all there right in front of us, right? And we've been talking about them for a long time. The question isn't, you know, can we get numbers that give us a sense of how weird China is in terms of its financial footprint compared to other emerging economies? The question is kind of adding the qualitative to that of interpreting why does this continue to stay in the air when it doesn't seem to have enough lift under its wings? And the hypothesis that we develop is that it is Beijing's policy credibility rather than some special aspect of the Chinese system or the data that have provided that that tenacity to the growth story. And that in fact, is the principal concern that that Beijing faces today.
Yeah. So that leads me to a big question, because in what I work on, there's not consensus at all about what the picture is, and the source of data can be really difficult. If you assume that that financial data is better collected, the universe is more clearly known and accepted, then gosh darn, why is there such a wide level of disagreement about where China's financial system is? There's folks who seem ridiculously optimistic, and those who seem ridiculously pessimistic, and they have been at it for so long. I am really hopeful that this report and you guys can kind of put to bed that kind of major disagreement. So why has it been out there that's such strong disagreement? And do you have hope that maybe this is going to push the ball a little bit forward and maybe folks will come to shake hands on this and not be as so divided?
We'd like to hope so. We'd hope that this does add some clarity to some of those conventional arguments that are made to explain why the system has been resilient so far. What's interesting to us is just how much the financial system changed, yet the arguments have not changed. Many people still argue that China has a very high savings rate, which of course justifies a very high rate of investment and possibly a higher credit to GDP ratio as those savings are reinvested. But at some point, it becomes difficult to see where that argument exhausts itself, and largely when the investment itself is less productive. And China's grown so rapidly in terms of the financial system as a whole that it's far outstripped the fundamental growth of the economy, far outstripped any benefits of financial deepening. You're talking about a quadrupling of bank assets to $38 trillion in today's terms over just an 8 to 9 year period since the global financial crisis, relative to only about a doubling of GDP. And so at some point, you have to grapple with the fact that many of the more conventional macroeconomic arguments that explain China's stability so far, the ground has shifted within China beneath their feet in terms of how the financial system really operates at this point. So we're trying to update that understanding, but nonetheless, we don't think it's it's more a question of those conditions being not really specific to the Chinese reality rather than, you know, a fundamental problem with the arguments themselves.
Dan?
You know, Scott, it's really not just a new phenomenon. It's been a couple centuries,
yes.
In fact, that the United States, well, the U.S., the West, I would say, and China kind of look past one another's facts a little bit and misunderstand one another and sort of see what they fear or see what they hope. And it's a centennial enduring problem. And thinking about China's relationship to the rest of the international system today. When I look back at the things we've done together, Rhodium and CSIS in the past, in fact, and even prior to that, we did the China Balance Sheet Project that involved some of us back, you know, more than a decade ago. And then more recently, Broken Abacus, looking at the real size of China's economy, what, 4 years ago or so. And the conclusion of that was that folks who thought China's economy was shrinking and falling apart half a decade ago were really wrong, and that by applying the economic analysis toolbox, you really could get a better gauge on what was happening in China at that time. In the same way, today, I think a lot of folks have kind of moved on past believing that the force of gravity is ever going to work in China, but that's not correct either. So once again, I think by doing as diligent, and indeed this is a little bit long, as most studies nowadays go, at over 100 pages, but there's a dividend from doing that, you know, very fundamental analysis. I think we can look back and consistently there has been an available interpretation of what's happening in China over the past couple of decades, which has been more predictive and accurate at getting the story right.
Okay, so we are getting better. We are getting closer to truth, at least with a small t.
I don't know that economics is in fashion these days.
Yes.
There's so much other stuff in the policy mix at present that I am quite concerned, and Logan is too, that while we have available these kind of analytics to think about where U.S. policy is going, it's not necessarily the center of gravity in strategic thinking in Washington these days. I would observe we'll probably be talking about that with your audience today.
Yeah, we certainly will. Hey, let me ask one question of each of you and then wind things up. Data is at the heart of this. You collected a lot of data. You guys are data hounds your entire career. What's the coolest single neat piece of data that comes out of this? Maybe something you didn't expect and you looked at the graph and you're like, Shazam, look at that growth of this, or where did that money go, or is it about crypto or wealth management products or, you know, the collapse of credit growth or something? What's the neatest, Logan, what's the neatest piece of data?
I think there's a chart in here that we also share in the presentation today, which is one of, I think, the best, most demonstrative charts that we've got, which shows the growth of interest on Chinese credit relative to the growth of nominal GDP. And so that's not a perfect comparison in terms of thinking about whether China can grow its way out of this debt problem. But basically, starting around 2012, which sort of gels with the narrative that we describe about changes in the financial system, you started to see interest at running at a higher annualized rate than even China's nominal GDP growth, which meant that it became more and more difficult just to roll over the interest on existing debt. And that's around the time when you started to see a much sharper slowdown in China's nominal growth at the same time. And so that really reinforces our argument about the linkage between the financial system and China's growth outlook. You can't think about the long-term trajectory of the Chinese economy without thinking about the long-term trajectory of the Chinese financial system. And so there's a chart in there that highlights that distinction, and what's different between China and many other highly indebted economies is actually very simple. It's the interest rate. Interest in China, debt in China is overwhelmingly concentrated in corporate debt, something the IMF has done a lot of work on, rather than government debt. And so as a result, you have to service that debt at a much higher interest rate than you can by just issuing government bonds and refinancing it. And that's a deliberate policy choice that China has made, but it now has consequences.
It's getting, as you say, to be a very big number. And let me then take follow on that, ask Dan a question. So let's say you're sitting several blocks away from here at CSIS. You're down toward the White House where you worked at one point, and you're trying to figure out, okay, we now have this more realistic picture of the Chinese financial system. Oh, it looks like there are some fissures in this system, some challenges. Is the right policy for the United States to try and gain more leverage on China by pushing on some of those cracks and fissures? Or do you think that we ought to be looking at this in a different way because really, because as you guys mentioned, it's mostly a domestic financial challenge? Or, you know, what's the takeaway for folks thinking about policy for the United States?
Let me grasp at a sports metaphor to try to answer the question. We're playing basketball, and the guy you are shadowing down the court is about to step out of bounds. The last thing you want to do is foul him now, because he's going out of bounds anyway, right? You're going to get the ball back. There are problems on his side that are not caused by you, and the only thing you know you really don't want to do at this moment is take responsibility for what's about to happen there at a time when it's not necessary to do so. Chinese people, and there's about 1.4 billion of them, are going to have a long memory. They still talk about other people's affronts from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. There are going to be things where we clash. That's just the reality of two tremendous global powers and civilizations. We don't need to add to that list unnecessarily. So right now, we should be very mindful about what we're actively trying to do vis-a-vis China's economic outlook, and also what we publicly are claiming responsibility for. I think there are folks south of this building presently who are almost bragging about the role of American trade policy in helping to precipitate tension in the Chinese system. I just am not sure that that is the most responsible course to take, given our analysis that there are problems of a self-made manner in the Chinese system already.
That makes a lot of sense. It's been a very good initial discussion. I think everyone is going to want to go read this report. Let me turn to one other sport to follow on from Dan's question, which is marathons. Logan is a runner. And as I understand, he just was in Berlin. How did things go there?
Not bad at all. Pretty rough last 3 or 4 miles, but managed to finish. So
fantastic. So
at 3 hours and 3 minutes, yeah. Which is like about par for him for the 4 or 5 or 6 that he does a year. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, I can tell folks that maybe working on this report was a marathon, but I think you'll be able to read this report in about the same amount of time it took Logan to finish the race and get what's out of it and the major takeaways. It really is a page turner. It's super important. And just because people need to know that China experts are multidimensional, despite the fact that they do such a great job collecting all this data, they find other ways to develop their talents. And so for the pride that we have, not in the just in the report, but in everything else that Logan and Dan do, everyone needs to take a look at the report, watch the event, read the other work that they're doing, follow them at their work at CSIS and at the Rhodium Group. Thank you guys for joining us today, and we're looking forward to the report being issued and the reaction that it's going to generate.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for partnering with us on it, Scott.
That's our show. Very special thanks to Logan Wright and Dan Rosen for sharing their insights from the work that went into their recent report and the implications for the United States. To learn more, you can find links in the show notes to the full written report for Credit and Credibility, Risks to China's Economic Resilience, available for free on csis.org, along with a supplementary commentary essay. In addition, we've included the link to the video on demand from the public report launch at CSIS on October 3rd, which features a comprehensive presentation from Logan and Dan of their findings, and a panel of experts from the IMF, Bloomberg, and CSIS providing additional analysis and discussion. You'll also find a link to Dan Rosen's previous report with CSIS, titled Broken Abacus, which presents a new methodology for gauging China's economy. The audio for this podcast was edited by Ribka Gemalongsari. This podcast was written and produced by Jeffrey Bean. You can follow our Asia programs on Twitter and subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS, or email on csis.org. CSIS trustees Ambassador Richard Armitage and Dr. Joseph Nye recently launched a new report titled More Important Than Ever, Renewing the U.S.-Japan Alliance for the 21st Century. You can find that on csis.org. Check out our CSIS Reconnecting Asia site to see a new study by John Hillman of China's Belt and Road Initiative that includes statistical analysis of 173 infrastructure projects. Also, be sure to listen to our podcast series, China Power, with Bonnie Glazer for interviews and analysis on all things related to China's rise. I'm Liza Keller. Thanks for listening.